Today's reading is taken from the book of Leviticus, chapter 1, and then chapter 9. Leviticus, chapter 1. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of the meeting, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Then he shall kill the bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Then he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall put the fire on the altar and arrange the wood on the fire. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, the head and the fat, on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But its entrails and its legs he shall wash with water. And the priests shall burn all of it on the altar as a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. If his gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from the sheep or goats, he shall bring a male without blemish, and he shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall throw its blood against the sides of the altar, and he shall cut it into pieces with its head and its fat, and the priests shall arrange them on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But the entrails and the legs he shall wash with water. And the priest shall offer all of it and burn it on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. If his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or pigeons, and the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and burn it on the altar. Its blood shall be drained out on the side of the altar. He shall remove its crop with its contents and cast it beside the altar on the east side in the place for ashes. He shall tear it open by its wings, but shall not sever it completely. And the priest shall burn it on the altar on the wood that is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Chapter 9. On the eighth day, Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. And he said to Aaron, "Take for yourself a bull calf for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering, both without blemish, and offer them before the Lord. And say to the people of Israel, take a male goat for a sin offering and a calf and a lamb, both a year old, without blemish, for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for peace offerings to sacrifice before the Lord, and a grain offering mixed with oil. For today the Lord will appear to you." And they brought what Moses commanded in front of the tent of meeting, and all the congregation drew near and stood before the Lord. And Moses said, "This is the thing that the Lord commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord may appear to you." Then Moses said to Aaron, "Draw near to the altar and offer your sin offering and your burnt offering and make atonement for yourself and for the people, and bring the offering of the people and make atonement for them as the Lord has commanded." So Aaron drew near to the altar and killed the calf of the sin offering, which was for himself. And the sons of Aaron presented the blood to him, and he dipped his finger in the blood and put it on the horns of the altar and poured out the blood at the base of the altar. But the fat and the kidneys and the long lobe of the liver from the sin offering he burned on the altar, as the Lord commanded Moses. The flesh and the skin he burned up with the fire outside the camp. Then he killed the burnt offering, and Aaron's son handed him the blood, and he threw it against the sides of the altar. And they handed the burnt offering to him piece by piece, and the head, and he burned them on the altar. And he washed the entrails and the legs and burned them with the burnt offering on the altar. Then he presented the people's offering and took the goat of the sin offering that was for the people and killed it and offered it as a sin offering like the first one. And he presented the burnt offering and offered it according to the rule. And he presented the grain offering and took a handful of it and burnt it on the altar, besides the burnt offering of the morning. Then he killed the ox and the ram, the sacrifice of peace offerings for the people. And Aaron's sons handed him the blood, and he threw it against the sides of the altar. But the fat pieces of the ox and of the ram, the fat tail, and that which covers the entrails and the kidneys and the long lobe of the liver, they put the fat pieces on the breast. He burned the fat pieces on the altar. But the breast and the right thigh Aaron waved for a wave offering before the Lord as Moses commanded. Then Aaron lifted up his hands towards the people and blessed them. And he came down from the offering, the sin offering, and the burnt offering, and the peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they had come out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces.
Thank you, Amelia. Well done. I think we all agree, well done. And can I encourage all of us to keep Leviticus open in front of you, preferably in a physical Bible. I think that helps to be able to see slightly more of a page at once. And we're going to flick back and forth a little bit as we go. I don't know about you, but I am not naturally drawn to the book of Leviticus. When I need to re-engage in my relationship with God, I never decide to nestle down in some Old Testament law. When I want to encourage somebody else at church with a verse from the Bible, I never flick to a passage in Leviticus. It's the hurdle we fall at when we try to read through the Bible in a year. It's culturally just so alien. Let's maybe just read a psalm instead. But that's slightly awkward, because then you read the psalms and the psalmist tells us, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth." I wonder, could you taste the sweetness dripping from Amelia's mouth as she read? Did you fall in love with the law? Did you cancel your evening plans so you could meditate some more on Leviticus? I always think it's best to start with honesty. We probably think Leviticus is a book which will just put people off God. And yet, ironically, it's a book which is meant to enable people to approach him, to draw near to God, to open up closer, more intimate relationship with him. And you could probably say that about most books of the Bible, because God wrote all of them. But Leviticus gives us a very underused window into what it means for our God to be holy and what it takes for unholy people like us to have a relationship with him, to draw near. If you ever feel a bit apathetic or a bit presumptuous about a relationship with the holy God, as I think I often am, then I hope Leviticus will be a really good read for us. And we won't have time to cover every passage in equal detail, so we've only got 3 weeks. You might be relieved that there's only 3 weeks. But one of our goals in a series like this is that it might help us to read Leviticus for ourselves, without being scared of it or bored of it, or, as I heard from somebody, falling asleep during part of it. Maybe in even to love it and to realize our need for it. So today we're going to look at the first 10 chapters of Leviticus. Well done if you took up the challenge to read that before you came. I'm going to try and give you 3 points, so that even if you haven't read it, if you went away to look at them again yourself, 3 points that might help you make sense of these chapters. But just hope, and there are handouts at the back if anyone wants to go grab one of those. Before we look at those 3 points, I think it might be helpful just to prove to you that Leviticus is a book about being able to draw near the holy God. So if you've got it open, maybe you might want to keep something in chapter 9 because we will be back there. But turn back to chapter 1 with me, where Amelia started that reading. And in fact, we're going even slightly further back. It's worth us just setting the scene a little bit. So hopefully, look down at the opposite page at the end of the book of Exodus. And Exodus ends climactically with the glory of the Lord filling the tabernacle. Tabernacle means dwelling place. It's an elaborate tent set within an enclosed court so that God could dwell among his people. So Exodus chapter 40, verse 33, and he erected the court around the tabernacle and the altar and set up the screen at the gate of the court. So Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. That is the basic starting point for the book of Leviticus. So then we get 27 chapters, 23 of which are just laws to follow, but they fit very logically at this point in the story. God dwells with them. He tabernacles among his people. Huge progress has been made. But not even Moses, did you notice, was yet able to enter the tent of meeting if the holy God is in there. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? Who shall stand in his holy place? Leviticus is a book about being able to draw near to the holy God, which seems to be the distinction in the words. So the words tabernacle and tent of meeting both get used there. They actually refer to the same location, but they're quite different actions, aren't they? So God dwells among them in the tabernacle, but if you want to meet him, then you need Leviticus. The tabernacle is up, but if you want the tent of meeting up and running, then you need Leviticus chapter 1. Let's read. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock. And the offerings that follow, if you did read them, they probably seem like some of the most irrelevant verses in the Bible to a 21st century Christian. But their function is to draw near. And it gets a bit lost in translation, but the words bring and the word offering, they both come from the same word that means to draw near. So four times, actually, in verse 2, it says drawing near. When you draw near with your draw near with a drawing near. It's about drawing near, in case you missed it. Meeting the holy God in the tent of meeting is the goal. This is a book about relationship. And so flip forward to chapter 9. We're just kind of looking at the outsides. Chapter 9, which is on page 87, in fact, 88. And chapter 9 ends, verse 23, we've succeeded in that goal to some degree. Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Thanks to chapters 1 to 9, it has become possible to draw near to the holy God, to enter the tent of meeting and meet with him, and for all the people to see his glory. That's quite successful. And sure, he's not cuddly God. He's not God the friendly ghost or God the rush of positive emotions. He's the holy God. So he appears here in a consuming fire. And naturally, therefore, they shout and bow down because their God deserves to be feared and respected and honored. He is holy. There is nothing, no one else like him. Now, holiness is not something I find very easy to think about. We struggle, I think, with its intangibility and otherness. Which in some ways, you know, that's just very appropriate, isn't it? to be holy means to be set apart, to be other. God is holy. He's not like us. He's not like anything. He is holy. And the Bible does give us language, different kind of images to help us understand what God is like. But I think we often overdo it with those images, treat them slightly simplistically, which leaves us with a kind of tension trying to put together bits of who God is. When we have downplayed his holiness, his otherness, and he can be fully just and fully loving because he is fully holy, we should fear and love him when we draw near because he is holy. But words only get us so far. I could try and describe it poorly, but God thinks there's a better way to teach us this. And so he teaches us about his holiness through ritual. So that's what sacrifices are. That's what most of Leviticus is. If you want to draw near to a holy God, then this is what he requires. Let me teach you about my holiness. So be on your handout if you're following along. Able to draw near the holy God through sacrifice and priest, as the Lord commanded. And I said ritual. We are a bit suspicious, I think, of religious ritual. And maybe rightly so. For sure, we do not need to keep these laws today. You'll have noticed we're not doing any of them. They were for Israel under the Old Covenant for a time. And we'll speak more about that over the next couple of weeks. But this is still God's word for us today. He's still speaking to us today. So as we read about them sacrificing, rehearsing, enacting, what does it illustrate to us? And I've gone for three things. First, the holy God is acknowledged in the costliness of sacrifice. I spoke to somebody this week that I know actually owns some cows. So that's probably better than the rest of us in the congregation, I imagine. I know there's also a church in North London which hires farm animals for their Christmas events, so we could have done that. I also came across a site online called rentacow.com, which I very quickly realised was not legitimate. But, you know, those difficulties aside in trying to get some animals, how many cows would we need in order to do this? If you need one for your burnt offering and one for your peace offering, and even before that, you needed a sheep for a sin offering, how often can you afford to make these sacrifices before your supply of animals is kind of running dangerously low? Remember, the Israelites are wandering in the wilderness at this point. They are nomadic people, and they do have lots of flocks and herds. But their livestock is their wealth. They had some gold and silver, although they used most of that in the tabernacle, I think. So livestock, animals, that is their wealth. And it's not just money, it's their livelihood. It's also milk and meat and clothing. Other cultures around the world today probably understand better what it meant, how they viewed their animals in a way that we don't really with our invisible contactless money. It's hard for us to understand how much it meant to sacrifice to God an entire bull, your best bull. Did you notice repeatedly in both of the readings, you're not allowed to give God the sick one that looks like it might die anyway. I think we sort of would think maybe that's the least wasteful thing to do. Seeing as it's dying anyway, let's give God that one. But no, it's always a bull or a sheep or a goat without blemish, a perfect one. And what is it for? What is it doing? Well, partly just the holy God is acknowledged in the costliness of sacrifice. He is worth your best. You worship him and show how much you value that relationship by giving him something expensive. And maybe we expect all sacrifices to be about taking away sin. So some of them clearly do that. That is a crucial part that we cannot forget. But several of the sacrifices are more about giving God a gift, or making a commitment to him, or giving him a tribute, or even just enjoying fellowship with God. So you might have noticed there seems to be a kind of order to the sacrifices. I don't think you always had to do all of them, and there's quite a lot of overlap between them. But the basic order seems to be the same. And we're gonna look back at chapter 9, because Aaron does lots of the sacrifices in order to help us. So flick back to chapter 9 if you can. The first one that he does on behalf of the people is the sin offering. So chapter 9, verse 15. Aaron presented the people's offering and took the goat of the sin offering that was for the people and killed it and offered it as a sin offering. So something about that deals with sin. Sin is dealt with first step. Then verse 16, he presented the burnt offering and offered it according to the rule. The burnt offering is the only sacrifice where the animal is entirely burnt up on the altar. A life entirely yielded in sacrifice. It was without blemish. Its sin has already been dealt with because we've done that sacrifice. But now it needs to become holy. And this transformation on the altar means it can ascend to God, literally, in smoke. Next, verse 17, he presented the grain offering and took a handful of it and burned it on the altar. So you make tribute to God. You give him a gift because he's holy. And then verse 18, he killed the ox and the ram, the sacrifice of peace offerings for the people. And that one, if you read, is the only one where the people got to eat some of it. It expresses that having ascended to God, astonishing by itself, you don't just get to make tribute to him, although that's appropriate. You then get to enjoy fellowship with God. He offers you hospitality, and you get to eat the food from his table. He invites you to enjoy the relationship. So that was a quick run through of a few sacrifices, maybe totally over your head. Feel free to go back and read some of the detail later if you want. But one thing is for sure, the cost is adding up if you needed an animal for each of those ones. Maybe no one ever fully understood why they used a bull for this one and a sheep for this one, and then they splatter the blood here this time. But he's the holy God, so you just do what he tells you. And the goal repeated throughout these chapters, 1 verse 9, 1 verse 13, 1 verse 17, 2 verse 2, 2 verse 9, 3 verse 5, 3 verse 16, it's always, this is how to make a pleasing aroma to the Lord. It's relational. The goal is to please him. Which means even if it is a costly process, a lot of money down the drain, you might think, but you did it because it's not down the drain. The point of this is that the holy God has made it possible for you to draw near to him. He's opened up relationship. And this sets them apart from every other people on the earth. It might be expensive, but it's also their unique privilege. And day after day, as you see the smoke rising and you see people leading in the animals to the tabernacle, as you make a budget for the year, and the top of the list is, okay, well, how much are we going to spend on sacrifices this year? You start to learn what words alone just wouldn't really have expressed to you. You have a holy God, and a relationship with him is valued above everything else. And it's an application of sacrifice that the New Testament picks up quite readily. So just last week, at the end of Philippians, do you remember? Their financial gifts, their gifts of money, were described as a fragrant offering, a sacrifice, acceptable and pleasing to God. It's the exact wording, the holy God is acknowledged in the costliness of sacrifice. Point two, if you've still got room for more. The holy God is also acknowledged in the bloodiness of sacrifice. So this is probably the one you were ready for first. We've spoken about the cost to the Israelite doing this in the tabernacle, but let's not forget the cost to the animal. These are not vegetarian-friendly rituals. Let's just go back to chapter 1, our burnt offering again. And I just want us to see how hands-on this process is. And I mean that literally, hands-on. Chapter 1, verse 3. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering. Probably more forceful than that. It's probably a pressing down, a leaning down with his hand on the head of the burnt offering. And second half of verse 4, it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. It becomes his substitute. And then verse 5, he shall kill the bull before the Lord. So it's only at that point that it hands over to somebody else. He kills it himself. Hard to miss. A lot of blood is spilled. In fact, it's probably all over your hands. And the blood plays a very prominent role, particularly in the sin and guilt offerings. So we're going to flick forward just to get a little taste of that as well. Flick forward to chapter 4. And chapter 4, verse 5, here's some blood. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull and bring it into the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord that is in the tent of meeting. And all the rest of the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that's at the entrance of the tent of meeting. So much blood, pouring out the blood. You can't be squeamish. And all of it in order to make atonement. Atonement is a big, important word in Leviticus. We're going to mostly leave that as well to next week. But it literally means at one-ment. So to come back together, to become at one again. It's about reconciliation, another relational word. Do you think that makes it worth it? Is that worth it? Slaughtering animal after animal? Quite an interesting diagnostic question of how holy you're willing to let God be. Is it okay for God to demand this, to demand blood? And if this was what it took for you to draw near, would you do it? Again, maybe no one ever kind of fully understood exactly why their animal's life worked as a kind of substitute for their own. Why was it even accepted temporarily on their behalf? But he's the holy God, so you do what he tells you. And this is how to make a pleasing aroma to him. Again, it's part of their unique privilege to be in relationship with God. They alone have a way. Gruesome, hard to stomach, but it's a way nonetheless to meet with the holy God, to draw near. Nobody else can do that. I wonder how much we even consider the value of that relationship with the holy God. How much do we acknowledge the payment in blood required to make that work? This book lays the foundation for what it means in the New Testament when it uses words like holiness and sacrifice. It should help us not to use those terms flippantly. If you want to get a sinner to stand in God's holy place, if you want to draw near to the holy God, then it is costly and bloody. And no less so in the New Testament. But God pays. And God bleeds instead. I think that is important for us to see. The holy God is acknowledged in the costliness of sacrifice. The holy God is acknowledged in the bloodiness of sacrifice. And number 3, The holy God is acknowledged in the mediation of a priest. Because, as you will have noticed as we read through, there are jobs which God will not allow just anybody to do. There are responsibilities so important that the average Israelite needs help, needs a mediator. And I think we understand that on a kind of general level, so there are some jobs that we don't just let anybody do. I once applied for a job at MI5, which obviously I didn't get. and maybe Megan did as well, by the sounds of things. But you, as you might imagine, there was a fairly lengthy process, selection procedure, because we don't just let anybody do that. And thank goodness, you're thinking. And we have even at Easton, we have something like that. So we don't just let anybody help out with our children's ministry. You have to have a DBS check. We don't just let anyone do it. Well, similarly, in these chapters, we require priests. And chapters 6 and 7, if you read through those, they are the additional responsibilities that the priests have in kind of keeping tabernacle service running smoothly so that everyone else can do their sacrifices. It enables the people to draw near to the holy gods. And chapter 8 is their ordination ceremony. We're going to look there if you want to flick that one open. It's quite a long process, and I'm not going to cover it in much detail. Feel free to just kind of scan down the page, though, for the things involved in making a priest. So we need some washing. We need to dress them up in kind of special clothes. They need anointing with oil, so does the tabernacle. Then we need to start on the sacrifices, sin offering, burnt offering, then a special ordination offering. Some really weird stuff with blood in like verses 24, 25. Blood on their ears, on their thumbs, on their big toes. It's a very complicated process. A recipe, if you like, to make a priest. And you really need to be able to follow the instructions to the letter to make sure the priest comes out right in the end. And chapter 8, verse 33, Moses then tells them, you shall not go outside the entrance of the tent of meeting for 7 days until the days of your ordination are completed, for it will take 7 days to ordain you. It's a 7-day process to make a priest. Did they understand why blood on their big toe? Why it took 7 days specifically, and then the priest was ready. But he's the holy God, so you just do what he tells you. And we probably look on priests as a barrier to relationship. So someone who would stop us drawing near to God ourselves. And I think that would be true for us if we reintroduced the position, and you thought that somehow I was your mediator between you and God. That would not be right. But for them, I don't think they would have thought that. I think they'd have felt privileged because God had provided someone to help them draw near. But remember, there is no other way. No one else had any access. And yet, for all that, there were still many ways that it could go wrong. And so chapters 1 to 10... they don't end on the climax, the climactic success of chapter 9. They end on a much more dangerous chapter 10. So just turn there with me, hopefully just over the page. And there's lots more that we could say about these chapters. Feel free to come and chat to me afterwards if you like. But I think this is an important place to end. They were now able to draw near the holy God through sacrifice and a priest, but only as the Lord commanded. This is how dangerous it becomes as soon as you don't do it properly. So chapter 10, and we'll just read from verse 1. This is what happened later that day when some priests don't pay close enough attention to what the Lord commanded. Verse 1. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer, and put fire in it, and laid incense on it, and offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. The closer you get to the holy God, the more privileged you are, and the more dangerous it is. More than a hint, I think, from this passage, one of the only narrative passages in the book, more than a hint that this law might not work, might not be enough. So let's land here with our view of God, our view of the holy God. Are you apathetic or just a bit presumptuous about having a relationship with God? As if it's not worth that much and it's pretty easy to do. You only approach God on his terms. He has to make a way, otherwise there is no way. So do we realize the privilege of having that relationship and value and fear him accordingly? I think it would make a real difference to our obedience, our thankfulness, our attitude in prayer, our attitude to the circumstances we find ourselves in, the circumstances he's put us in. And I think it would help us to reevaluate Jesus' role as the fulfillment of the book of Leviticus in enabling us to draw near to the holy God. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? Only by the blood of Jesus. Let's pray. Holy God, we acknowledge that as sinful, unholy people, we have no right to come before you. We have no right to a relationship with you. But we praise you that you are intent on relationship and you have made a way. Thank you for the privilege of being in a relationship with you. And help us to value and fear you rightly.